and that drew our attention. Rick, and when you get more information about that, please come back. Better go to Steve, who's been waiting patiently. KC2, Mike Delta Papa, what would you like to talk about tonight? KQRIW, the Tech Man.
Good evening, Dick. Good evening to everyone else on the net. Basically, tonight, Dick, I have a question about microphones. So I have a collection of, like, old vintage microphones from the 30s, 40s. And I'd like to put them in use, you know, time to time. My only question is, I'm a little concerned, you know, some of these microphones, you know, some of them are high impedance, you know, up there, 1,000 ohms, et cetera. Some of them are quite low impedance. I know I have one that's 300 ohms. My only question is, you know, what's the effect on these modern rigs, you know? I know I can pad them out and everything else, but I don't want to, you know, I don't want to mold any microphones in any way. You know, I just like to put a connector on them, wire my rig in, use them from time to time. And another question, quick one. Is there anything I can use to clean the mic elements, you know, some sort of spray to, like, bring this thing back to life, get a little bit of, like, gunk that's been built up in them over the years out of there, you know? I don't want to spray with anything that's going to ruin the mic element itself. Back to you, Dick.
Interesting subject. My good buddy, the president of the Long Island, the Liars Group, the Simplex Group, W2LIS, Frank, W2LIR, and I had a discussion on that one or two nights ago. I've got a theory that the electret microphones that many of our rigs are using, and you're listening to one right now, that in time, the little piece of foam in front of the microphone element probably gets a tremendous amount of absorption over the years of the high humidity that comes out of my voice, and it's all been collecting on that piece of sponge. So I am guessing that as that sponge gathers all this material over the years, eventually it gets partially clogged. Obvious by the fact that the high frequency response on this microphone, I'm convinced, has significantly decreased. And so electret microphones with a little piece of foam in front, I think, are subject to that kind of failure. Frank brought to my attention that there is an article you could find on the internet describing refurbishment of microphones. There's a service you can send the mic to, or you can do it yourself, disassembling the mic. And they don't tell you to clean that piece of foam. They recommend that you replace it with a brand new one of similar type. You don't want to be operating with no piece of foam there at all, because I think that would be deleterious to the real microphone element. But I think we should be disassembling them and replacing that piece of foam. Either that, or maybe we should be switching over to dynamic microphones. I'm going to give that a try in the coming week. The good news about the dynamic mics, and they've been used in high-fidelity audio systems for many years, is that they're pretty rugged, pretty flat in frequency response. In general, they sound good. That's the good news. The bad news is they tend to give much smaller signal output. A dynamic microphone, I don't know the exact numbers, but I'll bet you it gives millivolts, where a electret microphone gives tens of millivolts. So if you just suddenly flipped over from the microphone the rig was designed for over to a dynamic mic, your audio would probably sound extremely low. Well, nowadays it's pretty easy to solve that. With 50 cents worth of parts, a good operational amplifier, we can easily add a preamplifier. In some cases, when you get the service manual or owner's manual of your rig, you'll find out that inside there is a audio gain control. And if it's got enough range to it, quite possibly you could put on a dynamic mic and just boost up that control. And after a little bit of testing with Andy, WATCDL, you come out with the right number of kilohertz of bandwidth when you talk, and now the rig will have a better mic than the one that was supplied. I think the mics that are being supplied with these rigs are being supplied as electrets because the high-end output, reasonably rugged, can take a lot of abuse, and they're not very expensive. But the disadvantage is I think they get sour in time as far as high-frequency response, and I know that this one is lacking high-frequency response. Now, when it comes to the impedance matching of the microphone, once you've accepted the fact you're going to use an operational amplifier as a preamplifier, to adjust the operational amplifier component such that it presents exactly the impedance the microphone wants to see, very, very easy. By adjusting the resistors and whether I use it as an inverting amplifier or as a voltage follower, the op-amp itself, I can easily make the microphone see anything from 1 ohm up to 1 million ohm and beyond. And I'm not kidding. I can easily make that mic see 1 ohm to 1 million ohm. When you buy a high-quality microphone and they tell you to terminate it with 10,500 ohms, in theory, what that manufacturer has done is a bunch of laboratory testing. He found out that at that particular impedance of termination for the mic, it gives the best flat performance, or gives the best high-frequency preemphasis, or whatever the designer was looking for. If you terminate the microphone with a drastically different impedance, it's not going to blow up, it's not going to catch on fire, it'll just be a little bit more mushy or a little bit too bassy. And so you get on the air and you try it out, somebody will give you a report real fast. If you want to do the experiment, don't be afraid to do it. But you do have the resources by way of operational amplifiers. And in the old days, people used to do it with audio, a microphone, and impedance matching transformers. I can't remember the brand name of those little bitty black transformers that we all used to use back in the late 60s, where you bought the right microphone, and it gave you the right impedance ratio between primary and secondary to make the microphone happy. Nowadays, we don't do it that way. An operational amplifier, if you want to, could be as small as something that you would only see under a microscope, and you could hide it into the mic itself if that's what you wanted to do. So that's the elegant approach to doing that. Those are some of my opinions on that subject, Steve. KC2MDP, K2RIW, and TechNet.
Yes, very good, Dick. Yeah, I've taken a couple of these microphones apart that I have here, and that foam in front of the microphone literally turns to dust, you know, and I think maybe that's what's clogging up the element itself. For some of these things, you really got to whack them, you know, to get kind of, you know, any kind of response out of them. You know, just wondering if there's anything I could actually, you know, spray in there with something, you know, use press there for fear of damaging, you know, I don't use any, like, caustic chemical metal, you know, whatever, just try that. I was just curious, you know, anything that, you know, some sort of spray I could spray in there, you know, clean it out a little bit, thank you.
I'd be very reluctant to use any kind of a spray on the bare microphone element, Steve. The first thing I would do is put the microphone element under a good stereo microscope with the right kind of lighting arrangement so I could really see are there particles in there that shouldn't be there. And with very fine, sharp tools, I would touch those particles to see if I could dislodge them. Also, if I had the right kind of a... Sorry about that. I think I did. I hit one of the buttons on one of the rigs and I couldn't hear myself. Okay, there's something called UltraJet Chemtronics, which comes in a little bit of a spray can with a trigger on it. And if you squeeze the trigger real slow, you can make a very gentle chunk of air come out of there. And so under a microscope, you could see whether or not you're blowing away these particles. And you could do it gently enough that I think you would not damage the microphone element. So I would want to do it very carefully under a microscope. And if at worst you do the damage, these microphones are not super expensive. I'll bet you if you called up ICOM in Belleville, Washington, and told them you damaged the microphone, there's a 50-50 chance they'd send you another one free of charge, or they'd send it to you and bill you, and it wouldn't be very many dollars. So I wouldn't want to spray any kind of cleaner in there. I would use nothing but dry air, a gentle amount of it, and I would observe it under a microscope. That's what I intend to do in the coming weeks when I take apart this very microphone that you're listening to. Thank you, Steve.
Okay, very good, Dick. I know what you're saying. Yeah, that spray stuff they use for cleaning computer keyboards and so forth and so on. Yeah, very good, Dick. Yeah, I was just concerned because, like I said, you know, some of these things are quite old, and, you know, trying to find a replacement mic element for these things is probably the easiest possible method.
Yeah, but there are so many kinds of microphones we can buy these days, and to take apart the connector that's on the end of the mic and properly wire a connector that fits your particular rig, that's an easy way to go. So if you fall in love with a particular microphone that's got the wrong kind of a connector on it, you or one of your buddies can put the right kind of connector and adapt it to your rig. It may require a little bit of adjustment of the audio gain control inside. And if you happen to be like me right now, where I'm starting to fall in love with the old-fashioned dynamic microphone with very low power output, I have already committed myself mentally to build an operational amplifier, audio preamplifier, that I'll build into the microphone itself, and that way I'll get the right audio level and the right impedance and so on. And I'd like to believe sometime in the coming weeks you guys will hear me with those nice round voice tones like Frank W82LIR has. You listen to the 147575 simplex repeater group, and you wait around a little bit until that president comes along, W82LIR, and you listen to his audio, and you're going to say, wow, that guy should be in broadcast. I mean, he has done a lot of fiddling with equalizer networks and preamplifiers and whatever. He has studied the subject of high-quality audio, and I'm a little bit... I haven't met Frank face-to-face yet, but I'll bet you if I do, I'll bet you his voice over the radio sounds better than he does in real life. I'd like to do that. Thank you for any further comments, Steve.
Okay, very good, Dick. Yeah. Is there anything on the net that I can, you know, look up to build one of these little amplifiers if... Back to you.
If you just type into Google operational amplifier, or if you look at the appropriate chapter of the Radio Amateur's Handbook, and if you get a hold of, let me think now, Burr Brown is the inventor of operational amplifiers 40 years ago. You go to a good technical library and you get the Burr Brown third generation operational amplifier technique. It's a Brown book, the Burr Brown Company. And I think it was first published way back in 1970. And boy, is my copy dog-eared because it was used for zillions of circuits that I used on the Altec spectrum analyzers. The absolute value circuits, the preamplifiers for the frequency counter, the sweep circuits, all of that jazz came out of the Burr Brown third generation op-amp handbook. Also, if you go to Linear Technology, I think the name of the company is, they've got a beautiful book you can buy, which is, 8.5 by 11, 1.5 inches thick. It must have 25 chapters on everything you've ever wanted to know about operational amplifiers. There are operational amplifiers these days, Steve, that will give you all the performance you want beyond 1,000 megacycles, and I'm not kidding. Back in my day, I was doing all that design with 741 type op amps, which are good to maybe 50 kilohertz, and they start falling off fast. There are modern day op amps that are not 50 kilohertz, not 50 megahertz, but a couple of gigahertz, and they're not super expensive anymore. So anybody who digs his teeth into operational amplifiers and learns how to do things with them, and there's at least 50 different things, classes of things you can do with op-amps. If you live in the analog world, you must learn op-amps. If you live in the digital world, you will still have an advantage of knowing about op-amps, even if you're just using them for comparative circuits and absolute value circuits. So any investment you learn to find out how op-amps work, in my opinion, is a darn good investment. Any further words on that, Steve? Go ahead.
Comment, Dick, on it.
Okay, Mel, tell us your words on op-amps.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Exactly what you want. I'm just looking in the... I just happen to have the 2004 handbook out, the ARRL handbook, and I'm looking at schematic diagram of simple op-amp microphone amplifier for low and high impedance microphone use. A single PL081 op amplifier. It has a switch on it that flips for high to low peaks, and a gain control on it. Contains about, let's see, beside the op amplifier, about a handful of resistors and about 3 capacitors. So there it is, exactly what you wanted. This is exactly what they mentioned in the article. The use of older microphones, if you want to build it into the base, it's a little contraption, or whatever. They have a number of versions of it. If you want to use it, add a speech clipper to it, a number of different ways to twist it around, all based on the single op amplifier. So this is exactly what he wants. Vic, very simple to make. Most likely take you 1 hour to assemble over.
Well done, Mel. You've earned your keep for the day, for the week. What chapter of the Radio Amateur's Handbook is that in?
Okay, I guess you can look it up. This is the 2004 book, and it's in chapter 17, page 44.
Well done. Need any fill on that, Steve?
Comment.
Person with comment, go ahead.
It's Chris again, QCCH. In the vein of microphones, I picked up the head of a Shure Unidyne Model 55.
Very good, lead. Thank you. Let's see if Steve has any need for any fill on all of the above.
No, very good, Dick. Thank you, Mel. That was the ARRL handbook. You said that information on the op amps was Mel. And once again, guys, one and all, I appreciate the info. Back to you.
Go ahead, Mel, and tell them once again what chapter it was.
Okay, I guess it's most likely the in the newer books also. This happened to be in 2004. I just happen to have an out of code. I had made some notes in it. And when you mentioned that, I just flipped over because I know I've seen it. It's chapter 17. Chapter 17, page 44. Very simple circuit. I'm sure if you can most likely put it together, I don't think it has $2 worth of cost. So it's exactly what you want to put together there. I think if you take a look at it, you'll see what I'm talking about over.
By the way, one of the things I want to mention, last summer I was on a kind of a research and development project, an independent research and development project, which, by the way, was funded, in which I needed a circuit that presented many, many megohms of input impedance to a kind of a detector with an extremely delicate detector, and I wanted to load it with many, many megohms, and there are modern-day op-amp circuits that do a beautiful job of that. Texas Instruments has come out with something called the THS-4130 series of op-amps. I think that op-amp is good for quite a few hundred megacycles, but the magic of that op-amp is that it's got fully dual differential input. They all have that. It's got fully dual differential output. In other words, whatever signal get amplified by the op-amp, whether you're using it as a voltage follower or as an inverting amplifier or anything else. The output has two separate wires, a positive polarity and a negative polarity wire, running in parallel, running at the same time. When you start assembling a whole series of gain amplification with these op-amps, because they're one of a whole lot of frequency response, and op-amps are gain bandwidth product limited. In other words, you get a lot of gain in one stage, you're going to get very little bandwidth. Or correspondingly, if you ask for very little gain out of one stage, you're going to get a lot of bandwidth. I wanted both a lot of gain and a lot of bandwidth. Therefore, I was asking for like 10 dB of gain out of each stage, or was it 15 dB of gain, and I put four of those stages together. But because the four stages were being used in a manner of full dual differential input and full dual differential output, and the plus and minus lead out of the first preamplifier were going into the plus and minus lead of the next stage of amplification, and these are all op-amps. When you do that correctly, you get a ridiculous amount of hum rejection, hum bucking, noise rejection, and whatever. I ended up with an amplifier that had 60 decibels of gain, and I had great difficulty measuring the noise it created while it was creating many megohms of input impedance and giving me all that output gain, and the output impedance of that thing was 1 ohm. So it was simultaneously taking many megohms of source impedance, gaining it up 60 decibels, and presenting it as a 1 ohm source impedance to the output of that network. Boy, did I fall in love with those particular op-amps. And as I said, I've been using op-amps heavily since 1969-1970, I knew that subject. He takes a modern-day kinds of op-amps of that kind, or the kind that have gains settable by electronic means, or the ones that will do logarithmic transfer function, inverse logarithmic transfer function, digital to analog, analog to digital characteristics. There's a lot to be learned about op-amps. So here I am, 35, 40 years downrange, 35 years downrange, using op-amps. And last summer, I learned an awful lot on that subject. So, as I said again, don't be afraid to make an investment. The particular school you go to may not be giving you enough information about op-amps. Don't be limited by your school. Go and learn on your own. You go to Radio Shack, you get these things for pennies in the bubble pack. That plus a couple of flashlight batteries if you don't want to build a power supply, and an oscilloscope or a digital voltmeter, and a couple of these experimental circuits books or the other articles we've been telling you about will give you a lot of experience in that subject. Anybody with any further comments before we go over to Paul and find out what's going on in space? And because of Lisa, I can't think of Lisa's last name right now, the astronaut that's on the news a lot lately, we do have a lot of space news. Is there anyone who I didn't cover and I should have? Give me a call at his name right now. HYWTechNet. Okay, maybe none. Paul, have you been keeping track of what Lisa has been doing, the astronaut that was on the space shuttle last summer? And she was due to go this coming March, I think, and she's being replaced because of that episode that took place in Florida. WS2N, HYWTechNet.
Okay, good evening, Dick. Okay, I just wanted to mention Atlantis will be going up on the space shuttle in March, STS-117. I mentioned it before here on the net, but we're getting close to that. And they're going to put up the other set of the P3 and P4 for the port side. They'll be putting in the starboard setup just like they did back a year ago. And that's the one with the joint in it that will rotate. It also has a new 240-foot solar panel, which would be deployed as well. So that should be, balance the station out a little bit. Everything's on that port side. This will be on the starboard side. Eventually, you'll have another set of wings going up for the starboard side as well. And another solar panel wing that is already up there, sticking out at the top of the space station, sticking out of the Z1 truss. The Z is the Zenith one, the one coming out of the top. Out of that, they have the temporary P6 truss bolted to that with the solar wings on top of it. They retracted half of it last time. They're deactivated now. They'll retract the other one and then bring that eventually to the port side to finish off that set. So you have four gigantic sets of solar wings, really equivalent of eight wings, but each set is two. Big panel for the heat removal, if ammonia running through these panels, they're presently being deactivated. They just had quite a few spacewalks involved doing that. Without the shuttle on board, the only rescue vehicle that's attached to the space station is the Soyuz craft. So you have three members on board the station. They have deactivated radiators. You get a lot of heat in the International Space Station. They have to get rid of it. They have these panels sticking out. They look like some solar panels, but then they're really radiated. Ammonia for coolant. And quite a few spacewalks within like a week or two. Okay, you had three spacewalks, and now I'm going to have another one. The next one isn't related to this situation. It's separate. It's a Russian problem. So a Russian and an American will be going out next week to fold up an antenna that got stuck on the Soyuz spacecraft. We want to fold that down. The spacewalks, I think 6, 7, 8 hours each, they're just going on and on. And they're really pushing this to try to get the space station ready for future flights. Some 80 spacewalks have been done involved in the in this building of the space station. Some 50 of them from the space station itself. I think over half of them have been from the Quest Lab. The Quest Lab is like one big room that's attached up there. And that's the American side. When they go out with American spacesuits and you know, they'll use the Quest Lab to depressurize themselves for a day before they go out. The Russian side is a little pirate airlock. They use that for the Russian side. They'll be doing that next week when they try to fold up that antenna. I thought I'd mention that, and the Mars Global Surveyor, I think it's in bad shape. Mars Odyssey is doing good. But the new one that they just sent up there, the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, has some problems. Unfortunately, they have one of the problems on that big camera. Say there's noise getting into the camera, and you have some problems with some of the pixels that are coming back, and it seems to be getting worse, but they're trying different various things to straighten that out. All not lost. They have, you know, half a dozen different big instruments on board this that spacecraft, but they would like to try to straighten that thing out. So hopefully that works out well. You know, works out a lot better, I think. So, not much more of a lot of little things going on here and there, but I think we'll have more to talk about when the next mission goes up in March, middle of March, March 15th. Back to you, Nick. K2RIWWSQN.
Thanks a lot, Paul. Anyone want to ask Paul any further information about any of the above? Give me your call letters right now. Okay. So March, sounds like another. Oh, by the way, if a person goes to a website called Heavens Above, and the exact address I don't know, but if you simply go to Google and do a search on Heavens Above, you'll find this website. And when you go to it, you dial in your particular address, and in some cases, just putting in your zip code is good enough. It'll allow you to predict when you will get flashes of light from the various satellites that are in orbit, as well as the National Space Station and the Hubble Space Telescope, and any of these things that have massive amounts of hardware in space. At sunrise and sunset time period, when they're up at a high altitude in bright sunlight and you're down here on the ground, essentially in the dark, you're looking up at the black sky behind the spacecraft. In many cases, it's very predictable as the spacecraft tumbles when you will get a glimpse of light, and sometimes those lights is magnitude minus 8. In other words, the brightest star you can see in the sky on a clear night is Sirius, which is around minus 1. The more negative the number, the brightest it is. The moon, I think, is minus 12.5, and the sun, I think, is minus 23. So you could get a spacecraft that gives you something that's quite a bit dimmer than the moon, but not by much, but a tremendous amount brighter than a star. So by going to Heavens Above, they will identify those things for you if you're into astronomy. If you have the slightest interest in astronomy, every single Wednesday night, you can go to the New York Institute of Technology, 8:30. I can't think of the name of the main lecture hall they've got there. It'll come to me in a minute. But the Astronomical Society of Long Island holds their meeting. Very good group. And if you want to see what a telescope can really do, for you if you want to see John Vogt telescope. John Vogt, V-O-G-T, has home-built a 33-inch diameter telescope that's transportable. And he brings it out to certain astronomical meetings, and you stand on a great big, long, tall A-frame stepladder to look through the eyepiece of the telescope. I think you're about 10 feet off the ground when you do that. So, one telescope. There are telescopes and there are telescopes. When I go to these meetings and I talk about my 8-inch diameter Schmidt-Cassegrain Celestron telescope, I'm one of the smaller telescopes there of their 150 members. So a pretty serious group. You can tell they're serious because they hold a group meeting every single week. I mean, most hobby groups hold a meeting once per month. That organization holds a meeting once every week. Let's see what's the latest with Mel, with his indoor loop antenna versus his outdoor loop antenna. The last we heard Mel's story, he was getting fantastic performance as a receiving antenna with the indoor loop, and some pretty darn nice transmitting performance out of the outdoor loop. And although it sounds like it's a violation of the law of reciprocity, in other words, any antenna, whatever performance it has on transmit, is supposed to have a certain identical performance on reception. But despite all that, there's a significant advantage in using an indoor loop for reception and an outdoor loop for transmission. And Mel is about 6 months into this series of experiments, and I think he's going to have to write some articles on what he's discovering, because much of what he's saying I have not read anywhere before this. So those guys in Brooklyn are apparently pushing the envelope a little bit here. K2KUI, H-U-I-W in the tech guy.
Okay, thank you, Dick. This is K2KUI. Yep. And really using it, I guess, the entire week. The noise level here at times is impossible. In fact, I've tried to run down two sources of noise today, but somewhat deep. I get outside here and try to walk around. But it is. You walk down the street, you find different places coming from different houses, different places. At night, the lights come on. I think some of it is street lights. It makes it difficult. However, with the indoor loop antenna versus the one wavelength outdoor, one wavelength outdoor loop this week, the best noise level I had was approximately down to about 7 or 8. The worst I had was 15 over 9. Now, with the indoor loop now, the new version of it, let me explain what the new version is. I took the original version, which is approximately 12 feet in diameter. It was about 3 feet on its side, built on a square frame. And then the square frame is stood on end. So it looks like a baseball diamond if you viewed it from home plate. It's what they call a shielded loop. If you look in the antenna handbook on the loop antennas receiving loops, you'll get a basic glimpse of what they are basically what I'm talking about. However, I went one step further. I built a second one. I redid the frame to accompany another one inside that is 6 foot in diameter, approximately 18 inches on the square. And it's also a shielded loop. Now, both these loops have variable capacitance on it, so you can peak them to the frequency that you're listening on. And then what happens, I take the two, I built, as I was mentioning about 2 weeks ago, I was building the building. I built a regenerative type of system that will give me more Q. It's actually based on what you would use many years ago, which was very popular for Q multiplier. By bringing up the Q, in other words, what I do now, I bring up the Q so that I have that separation between the signal and noise ratio. However, in doing that, bringing up the Q, I found that I also was amplifying also some of the noise, again, which comes along with it. Not as bad, but enough to think it annoying. So what I have done, I've added a QRN squasher. You may have seen QRN squashes, which they use two antenna inputs. One is your receiving antenna, and the other one is the noise detection antenna. Well, I use a modified version of this, so that now I can phase the noise. So I'm doing another step, is I'm able to phase the noise out somewhat, cancel it out by the phase shifting situation that I'm using. And at the same time, I have an RF amplifier built into it so that I can bring up the whatever gain I'm losing. So with this combination, the only problem is you got a lot of adjustments to do. And the amazing thing is, you don't realize how many different angles you have to deal with when listening to a station. I've had the experience this week with a friend, my friend in Pennsylvania, and I know he's horizontal, and I many times receiving him better with the antenna in a vertical position. The antenna basically is a square quad type antenna diagonal. Yeah, I have it on a camera mount so that I can turn it, I can, you know, change the angles and all, you know, a regular mount that you would use for a fixed camera mount. So it seems like things are going on there that I would never expect. First of all, I'd never expect the diagonal noise be able to hear better on an indoor antenna versus a full wavelength antenna that's outside the floor and double the height. I'm on the second floor, which puts about 20 feet above the ground. The receiving outside one wavelength is 45 feet up. So there's something going on here that I never expected. K2RIW, the text message, is K2Y.
You've been telling me for a couple of weeks now to look at Chapter 5 of the ARL antenna book, where the whole chapter is devoted to loops. And there's 21 pages of loop information. Do I have it right? Yes, 21 pages of loop information on Chapter 5 of the handbook. And all kinds of diagrams showing you what the antenna pattern looks like. Once you know that you're using a square loop, a circular loop, a diamond shaped loop, and whatever, a series of equations telling you exactly how many microhenries you'll get out of the loop, which tells you at your favorite frequency how much capacitance it's going to take to tune it, various ways of shielding it. In the section on loop antennas, they also show a ferrite rod type antenna, which is a subset of a loop. Loop antennas in general are H-field responsive. Well, could you say that it doesn't respond to the E-field? No, you cannot. In free space, you cannot create as a real transmission in the far field. You cannot create an E-field that does not have the exact amount of corresponding H-field, and vice versa. But it's easier to understand what a loop is doing if you look at it as an H-field antenna. In other words, it's an antenna that, with simplistic analysis, appears to be responding most to the magnetic field that flows through the loop. And that explains why, when you see the pattern of a loop antenna, it is somewhat dipole-like, except the orientation of the antenna is 90 degrees away from the way it would be with a dipole. A dipole radiates broadside, a loop radiates edgewise. In other words, if I've got a flat loop that is perpendicular to the earth, and I've got the plane of the loop oriented north-south, not the normal to the plane, normal to the plane oriented east-west, and therefore it's like a sheet of metal that's going through the north-south axis of my globe, and it's perpendicular to the earth. That kind of an antenna would be most sensitive to a signal coming from the north or the south. So it receives edgewise, not broadside. Common sense would lead you to believe you set up the loop broadside to the incoming signal. You set it up edgewise. So that's normal loop operation before you start doing some of the fancy tuning and multiplying and back ratio enhancement that the male is into, then I think the pattern becomes a bit further modified. I know there's a section that you wanted me to see that you were telling me that I've got in the past in this particular section. I bet you it's on page 5-14, but you've got this fancy tuning arrangement on these. It looks like a loop that's made out of 45-degree elbows. Looks to me like it's made out of copper tubing. Now, that's one of the first ones you started off with your indoor experiment. Is that true, Mel? K2KEY? K2RIW in the second end?
Oh, Dick, this is K2KEY. No, that's not the one. If you look at the end of the chapter, page 23, you see a receiving loop for 1.8 megahertz. This was the basics of what I used in the theory. And the transmitting loops, or whatever you looked at in the part of this chapter, I only made one transmitting loop in the past out of copper pipe, and that was for 20 meters. This is for 80 meters, for 75 meters. And as you said, this is only receiving. And if you take a look at it, then you see basically method that was used. It's used in shielded cable, coax cable. And what you do is, I can see if you look at it as a diamond, as a baseball diamond. The second base is if the antenna is standing up on end, the home plate has the mounting spot. And if you look where the second base is, you'll notice that the shield is just split apart about an inch. I wonder if you have to have that manual. The manual. 19th edition, Dick, over.
I'm looking at that section right now, Mel. A receiving loop for 1.8 gigs. Gene DeMore, W1CKK, test the 1.8 meg shielded loop. I'm reading the caption on the picture. Bamboo cross arms are used to support the loop, to support the antenna. Yes, it looks exactly like a baseball diamond standing up in the air. Home plate is in her hand down at the bottom, and second base is highest in the air near the second floor window of her house. And so that's the loop antenna. I presume the next figure on the next page where it shows you split shield and the 400 picofarad variable tuning capacitor. I think you're saying you started off with that particular antenna. And did you make it as big as that, using it indoors? Or did I understand you to make a smaller version, adjust the capacitor accordingly to resonate it? And I know you've got loops inside of loops, so I'll bet you built a smaller version because that Gene DeMore W1CKK antenna doesn't look like it would fit into the room of my house. That thing looks like it's 15 feet tall. But then again, you might have vaulted ceilings in your house. Back to you, Mel.
Oh, this one is for 1.8. I built the one for 80 meters, for 75 meters. That's half its size. If you read the article there about distributed capacitance and multi-capacitance calculation, so I recalculated it, and I was able to squeeze it down by readjusting the capacitor, and I made one exercise that was approximately 12 feet. This one here is 20 feet, as it's showing here, and the picture was like holding it in place. I built the one minus 3 feet, the original one with 3 feet on its side, total 12 feet. Then I built another one. I built the one 6 feet, that's 18 inches on its side, that pivot actually turned to the side of this big one. I mean, they're both able to be pivoted and tilted and all, but I built another in plane, kind of a frame. I think I did more carpentry work than I did electronics with this construction idea, but I wanted to see if I built one down to 18 inches and it worked. Yes, it does. The problem is, of course, when they're inside each other, they have a tendency to interact. So by just getting, and the way it's good, because now I can say it works real well in a regenerative circuit, and I'm able to tweak it, so it's a pain in the neck because sometimes the QSO can be half over before I've done it. you know, justice, everything the way I like it. But the nice part is, even if you just were to put one loop inside the other, you can see that by adjusting them, that one loop will actually tune or peak the other one at a point if you manipulate the variable capacitor. And actually just tying them together, simple. I got fancy, I used a hybrid. I used the Wilkinson hybrid originally to tie the two together. I did that experiment, but I think I'm better off with the method of using a Q multiplier and take over.
Sounds like fun. One of the chapters, one of the paragraphs I just read in Chapter 5 says, shielded loops are not affected noticeably by nearby objects and therefore they can be installed indoors or out after being tuned to resonance. Moving them from one place to another does not significantly affect their tuning. Unusual antenna. And I think they're recommending that you keep the loop under 0.1 wavelength long. The dimensions are not critical, provided the overall length of the loop does not exceed approximately 0.1. So when you do that, the loop itself, if I understand correctly, has the desired ideal pattern. And that's very similar to what happens with hula hoop antennas. A hula hoop, a horizontally polarized hula hoop that used to be popular as a horizontally polarized 6-meter antenna, as long as you keep the loop circumference small compared to the wavelength and tune it with that end air capacitor, it's a good transmitting and receiving antenna that is essentially omnidirectional. It has very little difference in gain around the compass rotors. And at times it's very handy. But as you make it smaller and smaller, it requires a bigger and bigger capacitor to hit resonance, and the Q increases. So if you're not careful with the method of construction on, say, a 6-meter transmitting loop antenna, you can end up with such a high Q that it is so narrow that if your QSY 50 kc, you have to retune the antenna, and when it's resonant, if you're not careful, you can be arcing over that capacitor to say 100 watts of transmit power. I remember I had a 300 watt transmitter at the time, and I was amazed that a small 6-meter loop antenna could tolerate that amount of power without arcing over that capacitor. When you do your tuning for a particular station you're having a QSO with, you know, with your 80-meter indoor loop antenna with a 12-foot circumference, or even a smaller one, and you're tilting it, rotating it, tuning it, and doing all your things to give the best possible signal-to-noise ratio, you were saying that it takes a significant amount of time to do all that tuning. You're a little worried about the QSO might be over before you finish doing that. Are we talking about 60 seconds worth of tuning, or are you talking about 5 minutes worth of tuning? Back to you, Mel, KQLIW.
Okay, this is K2KD1. Actually, the station I talked to in Pennsylvania, Western Pennsylvania, my friend George of the 3FRY, I know already the normal setting of the antenna. I listened before, in fact, to the band before he gets on, and I know the conditions of the band, so I know already where I'm going to set the antenna and all the adjustments, so I'm ready for him. I have a number of different adjustment procedures here for different people. Like for WS2N, Paul, I got his setting, because once in a while Paul joins us. And then I got another setting for a friend of ours, K1CEI, up in Massachusetts. So, basically, as you said, the antenna is unique. I had never had experience previously. What I used is Belden 8241 cable, the original one, 12 feet, because I measured it and I found I had approximately 22 PF, 22 pico per foot. So that my distributed capacitance came out to 252 PF. And that came to an inductance of 7.3 microhenry. And so, with a capacitance of, what the heck did I use? A variable capacitor was between 10 and 250 PF to resonate. Now, when I went to the 6-foot using the same cable, I found on 6 feet I was 14.68 microhenry, which it keeps me under the... I don't know why. Basically, I could say 0.1 loop, of course. It's got to stay on the 0.1 wavelength. And it's got to stay within, with us, 15.